These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for June 30th, 2018. And just like that, half the year is over. With 4th of July coming up in the middle of the week, I'd just like to offer a public service suggestion. Keep your pets inside. According to every metric I've seen, more pets go missing during the 4th of July holiday than any other time of the year. I know our dogs are terrified of the sound of fireworks, and if they weren't confined to the house, I have no idea what they might try to do. Next item on the agenda, Tour de France. Yes, we are T-minus less than a week for the start of what is arguably the most famous stage race in the world. Not taking bets at this point, but I'll take comments on our Facebook page if you'd like to weigh in about your thoughts. So, okay, it's time for the meat and potatoes of the show. This week, we have a returning guest, one who was requested by listeners, by the way. Chuck Marone is Mr. Strong Towns, and things have come a long way, baby, since I first spoke with him back in 2013. He was in the throes of just fleshing out his Strong Towns objectives, and much to the chagrin of other civil engineers who still believed that expanding our automobile infrastructure was the right thing to do. As we fast forward the 5 years since we spoke then, there are pockets, his words, of folks who now see that perhaps investing back into our cities and towns in a local way, providing walking and biking options along with public transit, might just take us into the next decades more successfully. After a break, I'm joined by Loretta Henderson. I was trying to get this conversation going about a year ago, when off she went, traipsing 5,000-meter climbs by foot because her touring bike became really heavy to carry up those paths. Loretta, who is also the founder of Women on Wheels, an organization dedicated to women who cycle solo, has been there and done that on every continent, and her story is both exhilarating and hilarious. She laughs and smiles. You can actually feel her smiles through the airwaves and keeps accomplishing unbelievable tasks. So it's off to Minnesota for an update on Strong Towns and some very insightful commentary with Chuck Marone. Hi, Chuck. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today. It seems like it's been a really long time since we've spoken.
It does. Thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. My pleasure. So what are you and Strong Towns working on these days? I follow you. I get emails from you. And it seems like there are a lot of projects in the works.
There's like more than I could talk about. Yeah, we just hired four people.
Wow.
It's insane. Yeah, no, I've never done this before in that volume. One is replacing someone who's leaving. And, so we're adding three. We're actually working on some regional gatherings. We've been out doing something that we call the curbside chat around the country for, you know, we're in our 10th year right now. And I've been doing these like since year two. We just go out and meet with people and share a message. And years ago, it used to be two people would show up and three people would show up. And I would drive. One time I drove to the middle of North Dakota and three people showed up. But over time, the audiences have grown, and now we're showing up and there's hundreds of people that are there and they want to talk Strong Towns. And, you know, doing an hour presentation and taking Q&A and having a bite to eat or whatever afterwards with people is not enough. And so we're actually starting up some things that we're calling regional gatherings. I'm not sure what the title will be when we get to doing them, but the idea is to do something. We don't really want to do a conference. I mean, we're not kind of the sit around in a conference hall kind of people, but we want to do something to get people in the movement connected to each other and talking and working in their communities to make them better places. We're hoping to pull off, you know, two or three of these over the next year and see where that goes.
Like little symposia.
Yeah. And I think part of it is going to be us sharing information, but a big part of it is going to be highlighting great work that people related to Strong Towns are doing in that region. Because, you know, across the country, everybody's dealing with the issue of city insolvency different. Everybody has different approaches, and we're becoming, and I think this is in a healthy way, we're actually starting to adapt to our own regions. So solutions in California or the way that they would approach things there are going to be very different than they will in Texas, very different than in Minnesota or Ohio. And I think those the ability to highlight local things that are happening that are great is really good. And then we just want to get people talking to each other. There's so much capacity in this country at the local level to make positive change and to make things work well. They just often need a narrative and a platform to communicate with each other. And we're working really hard to set that up.
Earlier, as we first started speaking, you were talking about cities coping with insolvency.
Right.
I think that's
right.
What you said. So
I did.
What I want to know is what kinds of projects are overcoming that insolvency since they're not getting the funding that maybe they once had or thought they were even going to have?
I think that's a really logical question to have, but I don't think it's the right question.
Okay, and what's the right question?
I say that respectfully because I think, you know, we look and say like insolvency is the problem. How do we overcome it? And I think there has to be a recognition of why we're insolvent. We're insolvent because we've grown in a way, in a pattern that is financially unproductive. It costs more to sustain and maintain all these miles of pipes and roads and everything than the wealth that's been created. So one of the ways when we talk about, you know, how do we overcome that? We deal with the insolvency and we're like, well, if we could just get more money from the federal government or state governments, if we could just take on a little bit more debt, if we could just get a new big project. But the reality is like those are not dealing with the fundamental problem, which is the way we're building is insolvent. So what we have to do, and it's not a pain-free thing. It is actually kind of a painful thing. We have to have like a new diet. We have to build our cities off of, instead of a sugar high, instead of, you know, drinking Mountain Dew and eating Twinkies, we actually need to go back to exercise and good diet and being more well-rounded. As anybody who knows, and this is a cycling podcast, so people here have probably been through this themselves at a personal level, that transition can be really painful. And so what we're trying to do is help cities, first of all, understand the problem. The problem is not, you know, how do we get more money to keep doing what we're doing and keep this thing afloat? The problem is that our development pattern is fundamentally insolvent. And the way we have to deal with that is to start making better investments, start doing small things to transition into something new. And so when we get to the local level, we have members around the country and people who are part of our audience and part of our conversation who are doing things as small as, you know, painting crosswalks and putting in trees and getting to know their neighbors and holding block parties and basically building resilience in their communities. And we have people all the way up to, you know, people who are running for governor. The governor of North Dakota is a Strong Towns member, and he did, you know, a lot of this kind of neighborhood work in Fargo, did a lot of great development work, mixed use kind of development, and wound up running for governor. And now he's the governor of the state. So we're kind of trying to work at all these levels and everything in between and really empower people to kind of listen to their own calling and take the steps that they can. The way I always sign off the podcast is keep doing what you can to build a strong town. And sometimes what you can do is talk to your neighbor and, you know, just do little things in your community. And sometimes what you can do is run for mayor or run for governor of the state. And I think the important operative thing is what can you do? And that's what we're trying to help people with.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Chuck Marone. He is the founder of Strong Towns, which has grown just exponentially since the first time I spoke with him several years ago, many years ago now. You know, I received an email from a good friend of mine from a BBC News article titled, "Will the Bike Become an Urban Must-Have?" And I'm wondering how you see cycling, how that is being integrated into some of these projects, even on a small level, as you go around visiting these towns.
I think the answer to that question has to be yes. And it's interesting because right now there's this phenomena taking place largely on the West Coast, but there's some other places of the scooters. And I don't know if you've seen this or not. You know, the little, like my kids have these little Razor scooters that they ride around the neighborhood.
Right.
Taking these and making them electric and then actually having people be able to rent them in the same way that you could rent, you know, the bike shares.
I have seen it. You're right. I remember now seeing it. We're not talking about e-bikes and we're not talking about pedal assist. These are actually scooters.
No, these are like I would have said before I saw people using them who were not kids, I would have said these are kids' toys.
Right.
Because that's been my relationship with them is watching I've got a 9-year-old and a 13-year-old, you know, watching them out there doing this. All of a sudden, you know, I'm out in San Diego and we've got lots of members and one of our board members is in San Francisco. He said it's an obsession there using these scooters to get everywhere. And they're safe. They're quick. They're easy to use. It's interesting because what you're seeing, and I think this translates into the bike very cleanly, is what you're seeing is that the geometry of the automobile, particularly when you get into good urban spaces, places where people want to be, places that in a strong town sense are financially productive, but in a human sense are high quality places with people and jobs and interesting things to do. When you get into those places, the automobile is just scaled wrong. It is at the absolute wrong scale. It takes up a lot of room. You have to stay back from it. It disproportionately impacts the space. And in some of the greatest urban spaces in this country, what you see are scooters and bikes and people on foot just taking over. And the reaction to scooters is, let me put it this way. I feel like the engineers, and I'm a civil engineer, I feel like the engineers have found a way to essentially adapt to or accommodate the bikes. You know, we've said, all right, we're building streets for cars. But, you know, these bikes are like a necessary evil. We have to accommodate them. So here's what we'll do. We'll put in, you know, this thing. And sometimes it works and sometimes it's substandard. But it's always an afterthought. It's not the basis of the design. What we see in some of these places with the scooters is almost like, and in my mind, I just got done watching the Jurassic Park movie. Like, you know, these like just little dinosaurs taking over the place, you know, like swarms of them. You have these swarms of scooters saying like, we don't follow your rules and you haven't designed anything for us. So we're just going to take it over because there's way more of us than there are of you automobile drivers. And it's creating this cultural tension in these places that I think is really healthy because what it shows is that there's immense value in this place that's being wasted by all the space we're giving over to automobiles. And at the end of the day, I think that if that mindset, if that realization can start to be not only actualized, but spread, what we'll start to see is that these bikes are just insane machines for making great use of space.
Well, and that seems to be a premium. One of the things that I see happening, and I don't know how it's going to sort of sort itself out, is just the insane cost of housing. And then you have all this crowding, and then you have no place for cars to begin with. You know, traffic, congestion, pollution, all those things. So what are some of the current ideas that are coming from your work at Strong Towns to that are benefiting cities? Are you presenting them with ideas, or are they just feeding them back to you in these little ways?
No, we're doing a little bit of both.
Okay.
And I think we've started to create a real, I think, like positive feedback loop of us suggesting things and kind of laying out what a Strong Towns approach looks like. And then cities trying things and us kind of documenting that and sharing it with others and saying, like, look, this is what this place is doing. Isn't it great? It's very successful. And I think the important thing with that, and this is actually the place where we've probably run into the most friction with our dialogue. I think the most important part is that we stress working incrementally. A lot of our systems right now, whether it's building auto infrastructure or building housing or building other public facilities, we do, and the way we describe it is we work in large blocks and we build things to a finished state. We're used to building things very big and we're doing them in a way where they're done. And if we look at traditional development, we look at successful development, what we see is that the world's greatest places, the world's most successful and enduring places are built incrementally on a continuum of improvement. So nothing is ever done. Everything's always kind of a work in progress. A block is a work in progress. A neighborhood's a work in progress. Everything is kind of proceeding incrementally to a next state of refinement in a sense. And so what we try to help cities understand is that if they want to get off this crazy sugar high financial roller coaster, if they want to start building strength and resiliency in their own place, what they need to do is start thinking small and thinking about what is the next step, what is the next increment we can do. And when they struggle with this, what we tell them is it's going to be different in your place than other places. Go out and in the most humble way you can, observe people in your community and where they are struggling to do things. And then say, what is the next smallest thing we can do to start to address that right now? Oftentimes, and almost exclusively, I mean, there's a few instances not, but almost exclusively, when you go do that, what you see is that people have difficulty walking, people have difficulty biking, and often those biking and walking trips are what we would categorize as essential trips. I'm going to the grocery store because I need food. I'm going to the pharmacy because I have to get my prescription. If we can start to address, and we can, in small incremental ways, the very urgent needs that people have on a day-to-day basis, what we see is that we can create not only investments that are very low risk and high returning, we can not only create like a broad set of opportunities for people in neighborhoods that have been struggling historically, but we can do it with, you know, really improving the quality of life for people in places that are booming, places that are not, across a broad spectrum of communities. And I think that's the most exciting thing because it puts it in your hands. It's not like we have a one size fits all solution. We have an approach for you to use to help you identify your own, you know, your own set of responses.
So that brings up something for me, and I think it's an amazing way of looking at it. I think it takes you to a fundamental place where you're not biting off so much that you have no idea where you're going to, how you're going to swallow it. But we have two populations, especially that I have an interest in, and that is young and senior. And so young people seem to want to be living urban. Seniors, if they're going to be able to fend for themselves, are going to have to live urban. They're going to give up their cars eventually. Young people are not even interested in cars. What about transportation in general? Forgetting for a minute just a bicycle or a scooter. What about getting around in a city? What are you seeing people doing or suggesting to get people to actually go from one place to another so that it's not so congested that you don't have to cross a 7-lane, 8-lane highway?
Right. For a long time, we've thought that solution, that problem could be solved with automobile mobility. And even today, and I tend to get people a little upset when I start talking about autonomous vehicles because there's this sense that autonomous vehicles are going to save everything. you know, the elderly will be able to get around. The young will be able to get where they need to go. We can just have autonomous cars everywhere. And again, I think you're just not grasping the geometry of the way cities are light up.
Right.
You know, it doesn't work that way. But when we get down to it, instead of trying to solve these problems with transportation, we actually need to solve it in a fundamentally kind of use-based or place-based way. And let me give an analogy this way. We talk about in the engineering profession, road and street networks being hierarchical. You start with local streets and those empty into collector streets, and collector streets empty into arterials, and arterials into major arterials. And you know, so you start from small and get to big. And the problem is that when we go about a day, you aggregate all these small streets together, and you wind up with congestion. You wind up with things not working. You can't get to where you want to go. And we've dealt with that as like a capacity issue. How do we expand that arterial? How do we expand that trunk? How do we get more capacity in there to get more people through? If you look at the way we deal with this in an ecological system way, and I use this analogy because cities are human habitat. If we go look at other habitat, natural systems, and we say, how does this happen in a natural system? You will have networks of rivers and streams, and they flow down and they become major tributaries. And when you get a lot of rain and a lot of flooding, you know, you get flooding in those tributaries. You get, you know, huge amounts of, in a traffic sense, congestion, in a water sense, flooding. How do we deal with that? Because we're very good at dealing with this now. How do we deal with it? Well, the way we deal with it is we go to the source and we retain that water. We say, you can't fill in that wetland. You can't drain that farm field. You can't run your water straight into the river. You have to retain it here and allow it to soak in, allow it to be part of this ecosystem. Because by retaining it, you don't get the flood. If we go back to our neighborhoods and we look at how people live, what we need is we need to retain the water. We need to retain the flood. We need to have local shops that are right up the street that you can walk to. We need to have local jobs so you can work remotely. We need to have not a big box store that we all have to drive out to shop at and then drive back all like at the same time. We need to have like neighborhood stores and neighborhood deliveries and have things that be at a more human scale in our places. So both people who are elderly, who have, you know, limited mobility options, and people who are young who also have very limited mobility options, they're not forced into a model where the only way you can participate in life is to get in a car and travel multiple miles. They need to be able to participate in life at the scale that they're actually living. And I think that is the kind of the seduction and the kind of negative of the autonomous vehicle. The seduction of it is we can keep our current development pattern, which is in function, it was insolvent and dysfunctional and all these bad things. We can keep that pattern if we just bring autonomous mobility to these people who cannot otherwise get around. And I think we need to go the opposite way. I think we need to say maybe autonomous vehicles will work over long distance and you can travel to see your kids in the city, you know, 50 miles away. Great. But for day-to-day trips and day-to-day life, we actually need to make it easy for people to live that way in their neighborhood. And the thing is that's totally doable. It's not a hard problem to solve. We've zoned it out of existence. We financed it out of existence. We've done all these destructive things to make it not possible. If we just eliminated those things and got rid of those things, we'd start to see this kind of natural, organic thing come back because it is very natural to how we build cities.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
And it makes so much sense. You know, if you go back 150 years, everybody lived and worked and was able to get where he or she wanted to go on foot, on horseback, wagon, whatever it was, but it was local. It was close by. And then people actually got to know one another. Everybody wasn't a stranger, which seems to be another issue right now. It seems to have sort of wreaked havoc on our civility.
There's no doubt about it. And I think, let's be fair. I think, you know, we nostalgize the past And, you know, there's good reasons why people moved out of cities when they had the chance. They were congested. They were not well, you know, taken care of. There was disease. There are all kinds of reasons why people left. But we go to Europe today and people, you know, wax on and on about how beautiful European cities are and how wonderful they are. And you can even go to the small little towns there and go, these are gorgeous. The big difference between North America and Europe today is that we tried to solve the problem of the city by leaving it. And they tried to solve the problems of the city by actually making the city better. And we're realizing that our approach was incredibly expensive and not financially viable over the long term, and has all these other, as you said, social ramifications that we kind of have just discarded, you know, in the process. We call it a huge suburban experiment. That's very different than the way our cities were built and evolved over thousands of years. And not to make this political, and I'm not going to, because we're not a political organization and we've got people who think all kinds of ways on the political spectrum who are part of our conversation. But if you look at cities of the past, you always had conservatives and liberals in cities living near each other, working out issues. You were forced to, because cities were these amalgamations of different people. There's a great book by a guy named Bill Bishop called The Big Sort. It's not The Big Short, that's Michael Lewis, but The Big Sort.
Okay.
And he talks about in that book how in the post-war era, as we became more mobile as a society and started to move around more, what we found was that people started to self-sort into what he calls lifestyle enclaves. So if you are someone who's left of center and you come to town and you drive through the neighborhood and all the houses have trucks in the yard with gun racks in the back, you're like, this might not be the neighborhood for me. But if you drive up the street a little bit and they got a bunch of Priuses and they've got, you know, signs out in the yard for whatever, you're like, I think I belong here. And, you know, vice versa on the other side of the political spectrum. And so what happens is, like, all your neighbors tend to think similar to you.
Right.
And all the people who you deal with on a day to day tend to think similar to you. And you get in the real world this thing that we've seen kind of hyper personified on social media, which is you get these intellectual lifestyle bubbles where we literally don't understand people who don't think like us, where, you know, before we started this whole self-sort mechanism, you actually had to talk to those people and in an authentic way, hear them in a way that we don't do today. And yeah, I think that is a, like, treacherous, you know, hopefully not like extinction level fault with our current development pattern.
The climate is very polarizing and very disturbing. I find it very disturbing. And just driving down the street, walking down the street, riding down the street, I mean, just think about all the anger and all the upset and all the ways cyclists are harassed on the road. There's a perfectly good example of how civility is just, I don't know what happened to it. Well, as always, this is just a fascinating conversation. Chuck Marone, Strong Towns. Where are you going next? Are you home?
You know, it's really great. I was telling people that we just had a little staff meeting. I said, I've lost 15 pounds the last 6 weeks because I have not been traveling. When you travel,
you eat everything.
Right. Oh my gosh, you eat terribly. You eat to stay awake. You don't get good sleep.
Right.
So I'm actually home for the summer. I don't travel again until August.
Oh, cool.
And it's a blessing because my kids are home from school and I get to spend more time being a dad, like a real good dad. Not one who has to travel one or two nights a week. And, yeah, I'm coaching softball and just more active and walking more and sleeping good and eating good food. So it's been like a good life.
Yeah. No kidding.
I'm going to be in Arkansas in in beginning of August. And then, from there it kind of picks up and through the fall and the rest of the year, it'll be crazy, crazy fun though.
Well,
we're reaching a lot of people.
And it seems like you're doing some really, really good work. So it's strongtowns, all one word, .org. You can go through the whole staff. You can go through the events. You can even buy a T-shirt if you want.
yeah, you can now.
Yeah. And Chuck has written several books. So I have one weird question for you. When we very first talked, I remember how the civil engineering community basically wanted to tar and feather you. Have they changed their tune at all? Or are they still saying, no, we're right and Chuck's wrong?
in pockets. You know, it's one of those things. And Charles Darwin said at the end of Origin of Species, something along the lines, and it's been summarized as, you know, progress is made one funeral at a time.
Right.
He said it in his Charles Darwin way, which is more eloquent, something along the lines of, you know, this generation is likely to reject what I'm saying, but, you know, future generations will realize it's, you know, its merits and hopefully it gets its say then.
Right.
I see that happening. I really do. I'm 45, so I'm not young, but I'm not old. I do see, because there's more people behind me now than there was a decade ago when I started doing this. I do see a shift, and that's not to say it's all young people. There's a lot of, you know, people older than me who have shifted too, but the momentum is there. And so, yeah, I feel a little, let me put it, I feel a little less lonely than I did a decade ago.
Right. I remember the conversation fairly well. And I was like, yeah, I can believe that they're saying they were right and you were wrong. And it was so clear to me that you were on the right track then. And it's still clear to me that you are on the right track now. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. Chuck Marone, Strong Towns. He has a podcast. He has a wonderful website and there are books. And if you want to know how to make your city or your town strong again, that's what Chuck's all about. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Right.
Take care.
You have a wonderful afternoon. Enjoy your summer.
You too.
Okay.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
So much. Uh-huh. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Chuck Marone and Strong Towns can be found at strongtowns.org. Check out his fall touring schedule, and if you're interested, take part in one of his so far unnamed meetings. So let's take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to introduce you to one of the happiest people I've ever met, even virtually, Loretta Henderson. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back, and it's off to Canada. Fasten your seatbelts. It's a wild and wacky ride. Here is my conversation with Loretta Henderson. Hello, Loretta. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me on your show today.
It is my pleasure. We are finally going to have the conversation we've been planning for over a year, right?
Yeah, this is great. I'm glad we finally get to do this.
So I guess we have a mutual friend. I don't actually know Ron Richings. How do you know him?
He's a, we're both from Canada. He's a bicycle advocate. And I, you know, I cycled around the world for 5 years. And when I got bored of the cycling, I ended up creating a community for women who travel by bicycle. And Ron, a lot of people helped out with that, jumped on board. And we kind of know each other through that project I started. It's called WOW, Women on Wheels. And it started with me just posting a picture and saying, hey, let's celebrate solo female cycling. And it's now over 300 and a couple of websites, social media stuff, and a book. So, yeah, that's how we know each other.
I got it. So let's start with your background, how you became that solo female cyclist. What made you decide to get on a bike and go around the world for 5 years?
Well, you know, funny enough, I sort of somersaulted over the whole planning stage of all this. So, you know, I was like 36 and I had like a career and a boyfriend and like a house that I owned and was more or less utterly uninterested in all of it. And, I bought land, I built this house, and the whole time I was just reading a book called The Adventure Cycling Handbook, obsessed with this book. you know, I kept like looking, and at the time there wasn't too much about this on the internet, but I was looking and I'd see pictures of people bicycle touring, but there was never any women in these pictures. It was always like guys. So for quite a while, I was like, do women even do these things? You know, blah, blah, blah. And finally, what absolutely changed my mind on this is I saw this photo of this guy on a bicycle, and he had emptied out a plastic, you know, like milk jug, emptied the milk out, put water in it, and he tied it to the back of a bicycle rack. And I saw that photo and was like, you know, I still don't know if I can actually cycle anywhere, because I'd never cycled before. I never met a bicycle tourist. I'd just been looking at these pictures, fascinated. And so I saw this picture, and I finally went, well, you know, I don't know if I can actually cycle anywhere. I don't actually know, but I do know that I can tie a jug of water to a bicycle rack. And so essentially I flew to England and bought a bike from this book and just basically tried to get to Ireland. And the whole time it was just so incredibly painful because I wasn't even fit or anything. And so, you know, and I can remember my first big hill. It was like a 5-mile hill. Okay. And so I could get to the top of this thing. I lied down on the ground and I remember thinking, you know, nobody told me that the people in that book I've been reading are a bunch of lunatics. Like, how does anyone do this? Because my neck was so, oh, it was just terrible. And, so eventually I got to Ireland, and at that point I was like, this is the most phenomenal thing in the world. I'm like, you know, maybe I can do this. I might as well go to, where I've always wanted to go. So I flew to Bangkok and I cycled to Mongolia, and then basically a world tour, you know, kind of just took off from there. After getting to Mongolia, I flew home. The economy was super bad, super bad. And I was visiting family, and I still had some money left. And so basically I was like, you know, maybe I should just try to cycle around the world. So I flew to New Zealand. And then if you take the world map and you start in New Zealand, I went west across the world from New Zealand. And I tried to cycle on the water and cycle on the land.
Wow. Wow. Let me remind our listeners, yeah. We're speaking with Loretta Henderson, world traveler, female world traveler, one of the solo female world cyclists. This is insane. So let's back up a second. Because okay. before you actually did this, or during the times, there were years where it seems that you just were working with outdoor concepts anyway. So you had this love of the outdoors and for children and for schools. And then you did your solo trip. I went through some of your slides.
Yeah, I worked.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I worked for the school district for 10 years and have always been interested in leadership. And so in some ways, I feel like all I really did was create this cycling community to empower women, to encourage other people. I sort of just took the concepts I was learning at my career type job and kind of just applied it over to bicycle touring.
Well, one of the things that really impressed me as I went through your website were some of your slideshows and just the poignant and beautiful photographs, mainly of the people. And
yeah,
they were just so impressive. So what kind of camera do you use, number one, because people are going to want to know that, and which countries and which people were most impressive to you?
Okay, so as for cameras, you know, never had very good luck with cameras. I think I had a lot of cameras. I lost track how many cameras I destroyed. One I actually dropped in a toilet.
Never mind.
One, I won't even tell that story because it's just too gross. But one went in a toilet, one went in the ocean. And so I can't even remember like the makes and models of the cameras, but I tried different makes and models. You know, none of them were really expensive. Well, I guess all like mid-range cameras. But I've always said like I'm terrible at mathematics. So like I'm not too into like the stats, you know, like the techie people. I'm more into, as you could probably see in all my photography, more like the people and the culture and, you know, everyone along the road. And I'm forever deeply grateful because in so many ways I was just adopted. Everyone says, like, is this safe? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I'm like 5'1", like on, you know, a buck and change, you know, I'm like the, you know, with a permanent smile on my face, you know, like I'm just getting adopted again and again and taken in. And it's only because of the kindness of all these strangers that any of it was completely safe. And a lot of my photos comes from camping with families. Like people also say, well, how did you get permission for your photos? Cause there are a lot of portraits and,
right,
you
right.
know, like the shadows inside of wrinkles is like my favorite thing. But a lot of it is from families that I've camped with, basically.
I would say that your ability to capture the, I don't know if it's the essence of these people. It may just be accidental to you, but it really comes across as being just these magnificent people, the looks on their faces and the, you know, just, you can just kind of feel what kind of wonderful people they are. So you didn't have any obstacles while you were traveling around the world? Did anybody like, you know, like,
oh, tons. Everyone asked that. So many problems. You have no idea. When I crossed, you know, essentially I crossed the continents, right? So like west from, you know, west from New Zealand and then up through Asia and then Pakistan, Turkey, and then down through Africa and then sailed the Atlantic and then South America up through the Andes, right? And so, you know, a lot of this became completely off season. So like Patagonia, like in the blizzards, and I left like Egypt in a massive sandstorm, and like all of it was like crazy weather stuff. But, you know, I can remember like I rolled into like Cape Town after crossing Africa, which took like forever. And I met some other people and they said, oh, did you have any problems? And I just looked at them and I was like, oh, tons of problems. You have no idea, but I'm here. I made it.
Right, exactly.
You know, like I'm still standing, you know, and by the time I got down to Cape Town, my tent literally was being held up with a broken rake. I had like a broken rake holding up the tent because the winds just had destroyed the poles. So I kept like propping up my gear. And by the end of this, I was hardly in the tent for like a big part of Africa, just like sleeping out. And then at the, you know, when it started raining, I was like, okay, now, you know, cause monsoons hit. Cause again, I was completely off season. So in terms of any like real super dangerous thing, not really, because thanks to the kindness of strangers, it makes it all possible.
There's something that you got involved with while you were over there that is also extremely impressive, besides the fact that you just did all this stuff, which is impressive unto itself, that you make some comparisons with your life, the ease at which you can get like treatment when you need it and care when you need it and medical attention when you need it to the lives of women around the world. So tell us about the bicycle ambulance and how you're involved with it, who uses it, how it works, what it's all about.
You know, I wanted to, you know, like, I guess in some ways when you're doing all that pedaling, I always thought it was important to add different projects, you know, and so obviously like the WOW Women on Wheels community was pretty important. And then that after the trip that later on became a book and there's now like hundreds of us. But on top of that, I kind of wanted to add another project when I got to into Africa. And essentially there's a organization that is using bicycles for transportation of people who need to get to clinics that are, you know, farther away than a walking distance. And so basically a bicycle ambulance is a bike, and they have different shapes and forms, but that someone's rigged like kind of like a trailer, almost like a modified like kayak trailer, if you can imagine that.
Yeah.
In order to use it as an ambulance to get people to a medical clinic. And so so I cycled there, and there's a few different locations of these, but I cycled there in parts of Namibia, and the man has, it's definitely branched out. So it's not just one place. It's basically, you know, so I cycle there, and what they have going on there is really amazing. They're taking a a bike shop and taking old broken bikes. They're fixing them. They're selling them for a very tiny amount of money, using the money to run a soup kitchen for the people in town, and then also building these bicycle ambulances, essentially bicycles with bike trailers that can transport people, and then they're using them in the rural villages. So I raised some money for that organization, and I went there, and I stayed with the family, and yeah.
What's really interesting is I was at I think it was either a North American Handmade Bike Show or the Recumbent CycleCon, and I actually saw one of these ambulances. And I'm pretty sure it was an African project.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, they're basically DIY projects.
Right.
So it's kind of up to the community whatever theirs looks like. But it's basically like a modified bike and trailer that they transport people on from villages in order to get to medical clinics. So yeah, sometimes it's for because of complicated birth. Sometimes it's from like a sickness that someone needs medicine for. In some areas, snake bites to get to the clinic that has treatment for those things. So, yeah, and it's the entire southern part of Africa, and there's different locations, Namibia, Zambia. It started, Michael's his name, and it started in Namibia. And then from there, there's also some in South Africa and then Zambia. And I think over in I think Malawi has a branch of it too.
Wow.
But it's basically an advocacy program using bicycles as transportation, which is what people have been doing forever.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, it's really great. And then it's also community run, community funded, community supported. Yeah, it's awesome.
So let me remind our listeners once again, I'm speaking with Loretta Henderson. We're going to talk a little bit about something she's been doing recently. Before we go back to her bicycling, and that is, what is this about high altitude running? What is wrong with you? I mean, really. So what are you doing?
Okay, so So altitude in general is just great fun, but I have taken my bike over quite a few Himalayan mountain passes, both in the Himalayas and in the Andes. And I call it bicycle trekking, you know, and that's like otherwise known as like carrying your bike over like stupid, crazy crap, basically.
Right.
Just like insane trails that aren't even made for your bike. And so, you know, when I was cycling around the world, I was always wanting to be up in the mountains over these passes. And, you know, like India's got the famous like Manali Leh Highway, which you go over 5,000 meters like four times in like this, you know, a 5-day ride. And then over in the Andes, there's all sorts of like off-road trekking, you know, great for fat biking, great for mountain biking, or like just carrying your bike like a loaded touring bike. Because I just have a standard touring bike, you know, and I always thought, you know, I wonder if this would be any easier. Like there I am having like long aches and like dying, lagging oxygen. And I'd always think, I wonder if this would be easier if I wasn't carrying this stupid bicycle. But now basically what I do is most recently I went on a trip to Nepal when I now run trekking. So I'm still up at 5,000 meters. I'm just not bringing the bike anymore.
Well, how are you carrying your gear?
I have, you know, the one thing I will say that I have learned from bicycle touring for that long is, you know, I have a really pretty lightweight gear setup. And when it comes to carrying it on your back, I have just basically reduced all the gear to like the lowest amount of pounds ever. Like my last trip, I think it was like 3 kilos. I have a... It's like a running vest.
It's just light, huh? Lightweight running.
Yeah, yeah.
What about your shoes? What kind of shoes are you running in?
Just normal running shoes. I'm not, you know, in terms of like distances, I'm not exactly sure, but my last trip I went up over, I think it was 12 5,000 meter peaks and passes, basically.
Okay, so here's a question that I didn't ask you previously and that you don't know is coming, and that is, how are you financing these insane trips?
Okay. So when I was working for the school district, I bought land and I wanted to build myself a house. So I taught myself construction. So when the school district jobs were mostly contractor grant based, and that left, you know, like a summer season sometimes. So I learned how to build houses by taking jobs building houses. And so I built myself a two-story circular house with like wood heat, solar. And then I decided after all those years to sell it. So I used the house money mainly for my cycling trip. And then, you know, and I, at first I was like, you know, I'm not really sure if I should be doing this, but then, yeah. And so I used my house money basically. And my theory always was, well, if I built one house, I can just build another one someday. Yeah. And so that's the money I used. I sold the house actually after, like, I didn't sell the house to go cycling. I took the first part of the trip. And then realized that it really I wanted to take a new life chapter.
How old are you now?
I'm 45. I'm old lady now.
You're not old lady. 45 isn't old. So what's next on your agenda? What are you going to do next?
I don't know when, but I would absolutely love to run across the country. And then I actually have a friend from Australia, and he said, why not do Australia? Because it's a country and a continent. Check, check. And I was like, I don't know. I was thinking more like Asia or something, but I'm going to cross a country on foot. I'll ultra run across probably one of the Stan countries. So my cycling route, like I was saying, it took me like through like China, then Pakistan, and then Iran, and then like Turkey that way. So I was thinking maybe Central Asia through the Stan countries.
Yeah, I'm not sure how safe the Middle East is right now. It's sort of like a Tinder keg, yeah. You know? I might stay out of there for the time being.
Yeah, like Tajikistan, maybe. One of the Stan countries,
yeah,
I
okay.
think.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
How do you communicate while you're on the road? Are there people who are, like, watching out for you and expecting you to contact them or so you don't, like, disappear?
Yeah. Well, you know, the internet is really, you know, like, everywhere. So, you know, I was basically in my tent connected to the internet by the time I hit Africa. And I kept thinking, this is just not right. You know, like, here I am in like Zambia and with the ability to tweet, you know, and like, this is just not right. I mean, the cell towers are very modern because they're new, you know, and China's building most of them in Africa. And so you're very well connected almost like everywhere in the world. I think at this point you'd have to, I mean, even on Everest, you can, you know, there's email and beer for that matter at Camp One on Everest. I mean, the world is just so connected that that was never really a problem. So, you know, all the social media stuff, Facebook and then Instagram, Twitter, email.
Well, that Skype. Skype, here we are. That leads me to my second to last, my second to last topic. And that is, how can people get in touch with you, follow you, learn about your work, read your book, the big book, Women on Wheels? How can they follow you?
So I'm actually pretty easy to find on the internet. I think if you just put in like Loretta crazy bicycle, something might come up.
Wait, I'm going to try that. Wait. Okay.
I don't know. I just completely made that up. But everyone has always said things to me like, oh, are you crazy? I'm always like, yeah, only on a good day. But no, my website is solofemalecyclist.com and Instagram, solofemalecyclist.
Just so you know, if you type in Loretta, bicycle, and crazy, images come up. But the first thing that comes up is called The Other Butt Cheek that you wrote for Crazy Guy on a Bike.
Yes.
Just so you know.
Oh, that's the other thing. So I have two websites, Solo Female Cyclist, and then the original one is skillattitude.com. I would rather write like funny stories about being on my bike than anything else. So yeah, I wrote a story about crossing the Gobi Desert of Mongolia And I, the seventh puncture of the day was to my butt. I sat on a thorn, changing a flat tire. And essentially the other butt cheek is about what happened to my butt, basically trying to get through the Gobi Desert. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories that I wrote, actually. That was published a few times as soon as I wrote it, because I also write for other – once people realized what I was writing, I have always written for other websites too. And so that one actually was published in some adventure website somewhere.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Okay, so we know how to find you. So now here are my three crazy questions. What's your favorite food? Okay. And you've been all over the world, so you can have a really bizarre one or not.
This is kind of boring, but lentils have always been my favorite food.
Okay,
I'm
you're right.
Lucky.
It's boring, but it's healthy, so that's not so bad. What music do you like?
Anything with a good beat.
Yeah, I'll bet.
On my MP3 player right now, I think I have bluegrass, old school bluegrass banjo music. I have Shakedown Street by the Grateful Dead. And I think I even have a Justin Bieber song on there. So anything.
All right. And this is probably a moot question and probably doesn't apply to you because you're on the road so much. But do you have any pets?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
But no, I don't. But before the bicycle touring, I love dogs. And so I love dogs, actually, but no, I don't have any pets. But I do try to make friends with all the dogs on the road, because otherwise they think your legs are like a bunch of, like, you know, like chicken drumsticks, and they'll chase you. So I'm a big fan of, like, dog gratitude when I cycle by. I just say, thank you for not biting me. Please don't chase me. Thank you. I'm very grateful. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So Ron was hilariously right. You are just a joy to talk with. And we're going to keep following you. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. And I can't wait till this podcast airs so that people can hear how much joy there is just in who you are. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for letting me do this. This is great. Thank you so much.
Loretta Henderson, she's on the road. And just look up Crazy Loretta on a bike. You'll find her. We'll talk again. How's that?
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Loretta Henderson. So you can follow her at Scalatitude, that's SKALATITUDE.com, or just as she told you, type in Loretta, bicycle, and crazy. You'll love what you find. I want to thank Chuck Marone again for his insightful conversation, and we'll be back next week with Brent Curry from BikeCAD and Russ Rader from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety to discuss the new helmet study from Virginia Tech. And there'll be more than that, too. Please remember to check us out on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to our podcasts at all the usual places. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.